Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, October 1st. I'm Ray Graff. Well, for Mets fans like myself, the baseball season ended over the weekend. Good thing there's another season upon us, cold and flu season, like it ever really goes away. Today, we welcome back Dr. Eric Yeager, a virologist and educator at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics. He is here to take your questions about the upcoming fun that is cold and flu season. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. Always fun to catch up with Dr. Eric Yeager. He joins us right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Eric Yeager, Department Chair of Allied Health Sciences at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, joins us today. I think that's still his title, although you never know. He's done a lot of shows over the years. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from UAlbany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics, and he's here again to take your calls here at the advent of cold and flu season. How lovely. If you have a question for Dr. Yeager, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager, welcome back. Is that still your title?
It is. Great to be back, Ray. I appreciate the opportunity. Happy first day of October.
And also with you.
Thank you. I think other title would be the Ray Graff Fan Club.
Well, I tell you what, man. You have to get in line for that, right? How are things going over at the school?
Going well, thank you. We're about 6 weeks into the semester. It's going strong. We have students studying to be healthcare providers and a lot of activity on campus. It's great to see students. You know, summer we have things going on, but, you know, once fall hits and the students are back on campus, different energy, a lot of positive energy, seeing the kids that are learning, want to make a difference. We started our collaborations. You might have heard in the news that we're in a process of merging with Russell Sage, so that's going well. And
yeah,
we're excited about, you know, meeting our partners, our collaborators, and future students and programs. So it's a good.
That's got to be a weird time. I mean,
it is. It's a weird, you know, it's kind of an adjustment to kind of, you know, we have the academic side, we have the news that's going on, we have viruses and vaccines. So I think there's a lot going on. But
are you still teaching or are you just dealing
Yep, still teaching. I teach immunology in the fall. I haven't lost any students yet. They're still coming into class. They're still attentive.
Okay, that's a great.
Hopefully that persists.
Now, is this an upper-level course or is this for newbies?
It's upper-level.
Okay.
It's typically, you know, a third or fourth-year student. And I try to convey to them my excitement and love of immunology. And it's funny, I got a book in the mail the other day. It was, I think it's called Value Tales. I don't know if you remember these books. They're back in the 70s. I found it in a pediatrician's office when I was a kid. But
no.
Long story short, there's a book on Louis Pasteur.
Ah.
It's the Believing in Yourself. So in this book, there's a syringe filled with these soldiers, like marionette-type soldiers. And it just stuck in my mind of like, that's so cool. I want to learn how we can fight disease. So that kind of was my initial step into the immune system. And hopefully, you know, my passion for the topic is, you know, maybe if I can reach one out of
yeah,
the 40 students, I'm happy.
I mean, you'd think that the kids, and I'll call them kids, they're not kids, would be into it if they're going to learn. Look, I don't believe you take immunology for the easy grade. I mean, you got to take it
true
for a reason, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the students that I think for some of the programs, it's required, right, for like pharmacy students, for pre-med students, our microbiology students. So it is, you know, any course like that that teaches you about a system, how it works and when it goes wrong, what diseases get caused. I think the students really like that. They want to learn, like, how is disease happening in these different systems? And that knowledge that we gain, it helps us develop therapies to fight back.
You know, and we'll get to the topic at hand in a moment. But whenever I have a professor on, I'll often ask, can you tell the students who are really into it just by looking early on? Can you say, okay, this one really wants it?
There's a warming up period, I think, after the first week. You get those few students that they're really engaged. They ask some great questions either during class or during office hours. But I'd say by and large, the caliber of students we have at the college, they're all fantastic. And, yeah. you know, their answers on exams, their enthusiasm for, you know, maybe it's not immunology is our favorite topic, but there's some other ones. But I feel very fortunate to be at that college and to have those students I get to interact with.
Dr. Eric Yeager's here from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Cold and flu season upon us. If you have a question, 800-348-2551. Just got the email from over there in personnel, the other building here at WAMC. Tomorrow's the big flu shot clinic.
Oh, good.
So they're going on throughout the country at this time.
Yeah.
What is officially the start of cold and flu season? Is there any sort of hard beginning on this thing?
Typically I'd say you want to get your flu shot. For most of us, October is a good time to get it.
Okay.
A little early can go September.
Yeah.
It's kind of where things kick off. So right about time when school starts back in session, football is on the TV again. That's when we kind of think of flu and cold season. There are some other viruses like, you know, like COVID, for example, we consider it part of that cold and flu season, but that's kind of been throughout summer as well. But traditionally, flu, RSV, and with COVID spiking up a little bit as well, we consider that the flu and cold season.
Now, is that because people are indoors more, or is there an actual medical reason for that?
It's been defined really by like when we see a spike in cases. So when are there people testing positive, going to the hospital, unfortunately, with complications, maybe some deaths. That's when we start to see spikes in a number of cases, and that's due two, we have to colder weather. You know, we're indoors tending to be a bit more as it gets colder. Humidity changes that can impact biologically how our body can fight off certain diseases. Our mucus layers become a little thinner. So it's, you know, easier for these pathogens to spread.
You know, it was 2014 before you said COVID. I think that's the latest it's ever been said on one of your appearances
That's a positive sign. We can, you know, I do always, when I come to the show, I'm like, I got to have some positive virus news or vaccine news so we don't.
Is that even possible?
It is. There's some good stuff out there. We can start there. We can end there.
Well, let's start with what we know about now the vaccine for this year's flu season. Every year it's something of a crapshoot, right?
Yeah, the virus, what scientists, epidemiologists, clinicians do is they start to look for when viruses are circulating in the southern hemisphere because their winter or summer are flipped.
Right.
So that's when the cases first appear. They'll look at those viruses and they'll base the vaccine that they want to make for that season on those viruses that are circulating. So it's, you know, in some cases, you know, they try to match as best they can. They do pretty well. In some cases, the virus changes kind of as the vaccine is being produced. So you hear the term match. How much did the vaccine match?
Right.
And even if the match is not, you know, 100%, it might be lower than that. There's still a great benefit to the vaccine in terms of, you know, reducing severity, reducing complications. There's secondary effects. So individuals that have cardiovascular disease, if they get the flu vaccine, that can help prevent. There's some studies out there suggesting that it reduces the incidence of cardiovascular events. So even if the vaccine is not a perfect match, it still has benefit.
Why would a flu trigger a cardiovascular event?
Great question. So with this virus impacting the respiratory system, it can cause a strain on other systems in the body. So if, you know, you're having trouble breathing, it's impacting circulation, that could have an impact on your cardiovascular health as well. So you'll hear the term risk factor when we talk about flu with respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, or even COVID. There are certain groups that are, you know, had a higher risk for complications and hospitalization. So typically individuals that have, you know, cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, sometimes metabolic disease like diabetes, you know, doctors will look towards those patients a bit more carefully because they could have some complications.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Our guest today is Dr. Eric Yeager, Department Chair of Allied Health Sciences at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He is a virologist, among many other things. When they make a vaccine for each given year, they're looking at trends in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah.
How do they alter? In other words, let me make this a simple question since we're going to a break.
Yeah.
How different is this vaccine from the one last year, and how was it altered?
So they're looking for, so there are strains of flu. So there's influenza A, influenza B. So there are certain strains that have been consistently going through the human population, but they start to change their outer membrane protein. So it's basically they're changing maybe a shirt color. You know, so they were wearing yellow last year, this year they're wearing green. So the color change is just enough that it fools our immune system. Our antibodies that we developed the year before, or if we were infected the year before, aren't able to recognize the virus and prevent it from causing disease. So the flu virus is very good at changing how it looks, changing its coat. So each year we have to reformulate that vaccine. In some cases, those changes are quite large. You might remember back in 2009, we had the swine flu H1N1.
That was
a dramatic change called a reassortment. In that case, there's, you know, little or no existing immunity in the population, and that could be problematic.
And why would something like that pop up? Why this reassortment? Why was that such an event?
For this virus, for flu, it's able to infect birds, horses, humans, and pigs. And this reassortment requires typically in pigs, they're able to house both human flu strains, bird flu strains, and they kind of intermix together, kind of like shuffling you know, their genes together. And then it creates a whole new virus. And then that it can escape and that can cause pandemics. And that's likely how, that's why there was such concern back in 2009, because that's how the 1918 flu arose, through that type of reassortment. Now, again, this is a rarer occurrence. But the viruses that we see on a yearly basis, we use the terms antigenic shift versus drift. So drift is, again, a slight change in how the virus looks, still able to infect, still able to cause disease, but our antibodies that are in our system can't recognize it as well.
Interesting. Now, if our antibodies are built up the prior year, will our body remember it the next year if last year's model shows up?
There could be some cross-reactivity, but because there's pressure on the virus to change, it changes enough that typically the antibodies aren't sufficient. Now, there's another arm of our immune system called T cells, and T cells recognize more conserved parts of viruses. So those are still able to act. So I think the T cells, in concert with getting an updated vaccine, is kind of setting yourself up to be protected.
You know, man, all these terms you bring up, I may not know what they all mean in depth, but because of the number of appearances you had during the pandemic, I sort of understand it. Let's take a break. Dr. Eric Yeager's here, and I'll quit while I'm ahead. 800-348-2551. We'll get to your calls in a moment. Old Cool and the Gang song from the 60s, that's Sea of Tranquility, and as redone by The Skinny out of Chicago here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Sure, I like the music. It's one of my weaknesses. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest today, and we talk virology and immune system stuff and whatever. Let's go to Nancy in Saratoga. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. So I really enjoy listening to the doctor speak, so thank you so much for being on today. But what I was kind of wondering was, you know, a lot of your audience maybe doesn't have the 2 years of science background that or more years of science background that your students have. And I wonder how, when you encounter somebody that doesn't have that science background, how you explain, you know, that which you teach and that which you're talking about today, you know, like kind of like dumbing it down. I hate to say it that way, but.
Well, he has to do that for me every time. It's fine, Nancy.
Yeah, so I just wondered if he, you know, kind of just give people a primer, you know.
Sure.
I really, really enjoyed it. And thank you for answering. I would get off so you can talk.
Nancy, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Nancy. Nancy's a great point, like the importance of scientific communication, especially nowadays, right? To have the ability to, you know, really to make something seem relevant to the layperson. And, you know, the immune system, it is a complex biology. And again, the students that take it, you know, it's a little frightening at first, but the immune system really is how our body defends itself on a daily basis from disease. And we have parts of our immune system that work right when you're born, ready to go. And, you know, things like our skin, our mucus that our body produces, things that are in our tears and saliva. And then if that fails, we have a more specific immune system that takes a little bit longer to develop, a few weeks, but is more specific and gives us long-lasting protection. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, there's different analogies you can use. You can use like a war analogy, a sports analogy, but really it's kind of breaking it down for the students. And even, you know, there's some great books even for kids, like what your immune system is, like that book I mentioned that I found in a pediatric office, right? It's just
A syringe full of soldiers,
right? Yes. It's just how our body fights off these diseases. And it's that's what really fascinated me, is that there's such beauty in how the system works and how it's orchestrated that, you know, on a daily basis, you know, it's glad that it works because we're here.
Right. You know, our immune systems, do they wane? And I saw an ad on TV about, I think it was the pneumonia vaccine, and at certain age, 65 or whatever, they say, oh, yeah, you got to get the stronger dose. Why? Why does it? If our body's continually learning about the different keys to these viruses. What happens? Do we forget?
Yeah, there's a wealth of data, and it was one of the areas of research I was involved in graduate school and as a postdoc was what happens as we age. And there's known changes that take place both in that early response I mentioned. We call that the innate response, and then what we call the adaptive, our T cells and the antibodies. So unfortunately, as we age, the immune system does change. In some cases, it becomes weaker. And that's why you see the incidence of infectious disease, the incidence of certain diseases that may have an immune component. And that includes like cardiovascular disease, autoimmunity, things like that. So
why does it weaken?
There's a number of different factors that can do that. There's some theories that if you're infected of certain latent viruses like CMV, that chronic inflammation might drive things a little askew, so your immune system doesn't work quite the way it should.
Mm-hmm.
There's an organ called the thymus that produces our T cells. That becomes smaller, so your body produces fewer T cells. Kind of think of it as a faucet running. You know, it's not completely off, but you start to turn the water pressure down. It starts to dribble out. So it seems a little depressing. Oh, the immune system is getting weaker. It's important to have an information because, as you mentioned, Ray, then scientists can go, well, how can we improve that response to disease? And we can make vaccines that, again, a high dose, for example. So in some cases, just giving more of an antigen in a vaccine to a person can protect that older person.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest today from Albany College of Pharmacy on Health Sciences. The number is 800-348-2551. Before we get to our next call, and Cookie and Somers will be next. What's RSV? I keep seeing ads for this.
RSV is respiratory syncytial virus. So it's another airborne respiratory virus that kind of travels along with flu during cold and flu season. It causes a large number of hospitalizations and unfortunate fatalities in very young and very old. And it's been kind of on the radar. It's not something that's like all of a sudden new. Like clinicians and scientists have known about it. But kind of the more recent developments is that the therapeutics, preventive measures we have against that virus have increased dramatically over the past 2-3 years. So we have a vaccine, several vaccines available for older population. And we have a vaccine for pregnant individuals. And then we have what are called monoclonal antibodies we can give to young children. So those are the three risk groups, older individuals, pregnant individuals. And we want to really, not getting too much into the biology, but the maternal immune system can provide antibodies to the child, and that antibodies kind of persist for a certain period after birth. There's breast milk as well. It delivers antibodies. But vaccinating the mother is intended both to protect the pregnant individual but also the child, because this virus can cause, you know, severe respiratory conditions in young children, particularly those that are premature, might have some pre-existing issues as you get older too. So it can be – it's like flu. Like sometimes you think of flu, like, oh, it's just flu. Like, what? I don't have to worry about the flu.
Right.
But as you get, you know, older, like we are.
I worry about
you start
everything
to worry
now,
about it, right?
Yes. Our guest today is Dr. Eric Yeager, and you mentioned monoclonal antibodies. And maybe if we have time later, I'll ask some follow-ups on that. But let's go to Cookie in Somers. Cookie, you're on.
Hi. What is your suggestion regarding the new pneumonia vaccine that's out? And for... and the age group, and why did it come out, and just anything you can tell us about it, and should I rush out and get it?
That's a great question. Is that new? I had one this year.
Thanks for that question, Cookie. So with the pneumococcal vaccines, there's shifting to a bacteria. So the bacteria here that causes bacterial pneumonia, a little bit about the microbiology is this bacteria is tricky, and it has what's called a capsule. And that capsule, it allows like antibodies to kind of slide off.
Oh.
So it's you want to get better antibodies. So the way scientists, traditional vaccines didn't quite do it. So they developed a technology called conjugate vaccines, which activated the T cells I mentioned before to help B cells to kind of work together in concert to make better antibody responses. So this conjugate vaccine, the reason why it's important is because with pneumococcal bacteria, they have, just like I talked about with viruses, they have different coats or color, like clothing, if you will. So they can confuse our immune system by how many different proteins, the capsule they have. So these vaccines for pneumococcal, they have different, what are called, like, you know, there's a 23 variant, I think. There's 21. I can't remember the number. I apologize. But the vaccine includes a number of different molecules called antigens where our immune system's targeting it for the different strains someone might be in contact with. And pneumococcal is one of those pathogens that is known to cause more complications as you get older. So that's a vaccine that clinicians recommend, the CDC recommends for older individuals to prevent Again, severe complications in pneumonia. So, you know, I would say, Cookie, working with your doctor is, you know, thinking of your age group, any other pre-existing health conditions, like those vaccines are important to get if you fit into that age group where there's an increased risk or a health condition. So they do work quite well. And again, the vaccines have been kind of formulated to match what are the strains that are causing disease now.
How long do they last?
Good question. I'd have to look that up. But there are some vaccines like tetanus that can last decades. There are some vaccines that you may have to get kind of boosters regularly. And it's based partly on the pathogen or the microbe causing the disease, partly based on the vaccine type.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Cookie, you want to follow up very quickly?
Well, I'm almost 91. What do you think?
Well, you don't sign 91. You don't sign 91.
No, you sound, you sound good. I mean, you can't really say, can you, Eric?
I think typically the definition of an older individual is typically 65 and older. So you would fall within that group that, you know, typically looking at the recommendations on the CDC and other groups, you're at a risk for complications.
All right. Hey, Cookie, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Tig wrote in. Here, look at that. There's the book, right?
There it is. It's a fantastic read.
He read it himself there in the old days. All right, let's go to Deer Park, and it's Samantha's turn. Samantha, you're on.
Hi, my name is Samantha.
Right.
I work in the ICU, and I have a couple questions about vaccines for children. You talked about, it reminded me that I also have a question about.
Hey, Samantha, can I stop you for a sec, Samantha? You might be in a bad spot. Are you in your car, I assume? I don't know what you can do to make it better, but we're having a little difficulty hearing you.
Can you hear me now?
It's breaking up. You want me to put you on hold and give you a try after the next caller?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, let me give that a shot here if I can figure out how to do it. All right, I think Samantha's on hold now. And let's go to Nathan, who's in North Adams. Nathan, you're on.
Hey, Ray. Hey, Doc.
Howdy.
Hey, Nathan.
How are you both?
Well, thank you.
Pretty good.
So I have a rare blood disorder called HAE. I know you probably heard of it, but I was wondering if flu shots, I already took my pneumonia shot like probably last year. Wondering if I'm still good on that one or if the flu shot would be good for me.
Yeah, there's so thank you for your question, Nathan. So there are individuals that we consider weakened immune system, you hear the term immunocompromised, and that can arise from different conditions like your health status. It can, you know, certain drugs that individuals might be taking. And it is known that if people that have a weakened immune system, they may not respond as robustly to a vaccine. So their schedule of vaccines might change. So I think, you know, definitely if you're at a risk for disease, and I think someone that's immunocompromised, you know, there is a concern of maybe if you get flu or something else that could be, you know, you could experience complications. So I do believe the current
I know that for a fact, Doc, because I feel like, I'm sorry for my language, but I feel like shit when I get a cold.
No, we can't do that. We can't do it, man.
I think it's definitely, working with your doctors. I presume you probably have like a regular doctor or maybe an immunologist or allergist that you work with.
But, yeah, I got an immunologist. Yeah. I go see her in Westfield every 6 to 8 months.
And a lot of these are kind of what we call like shared decision making. So like, you know, it takes into account like, you know, your health status, the risk for that disease. And there are tests you can do to see like how well your body responded to a vaccine. We talked about antibodies, for example. So you wouldn't do this with every patient, but you can do tests to see did this person respond well to the vaccine? Is their antibody level low enough?
Well, I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
So there could be, you know, and maybe that's something that you and your doctor can discuss like, hey, I got the shot, but I don't know if I'm protected or not. You know, just because you're having a weakened immune system, it doesn't mean the vaccine's not going to work at all. It just means it might work, a little less vigorously than other individuals. And in some cases, they have formulations of vaccines. We talked about with the elderly. In some cases, they don't respond as well. So they give like either more frequent doses or a higher dose of a vaccine.
All right, Nathan. Hey, thanks for the call. And just a reminder to all our callers, you know, if you could refrain from saying any of the words that George Carlin famously said in his routine, that would be swell. And then Mike Bowen, the engineer, and I don't have to sweat out whether the delay works. Jim is in Matamoros. Jim, keep it clean.
The vesicular stomatitis and vaccinia viruses are used in combination, and mpox or monkeypox used by itself to fight cancer? Are there any other ones?
Yeah, I'm glad. Thank you for your question, Jim. And, you know, we're kind of on like a positive topic, right? When viruses are being used to help us. So we have all this knowledge about viruses, their biology, how they infect cells, their genetics. So what Jim's talking about, what we call oncolytic therapy. So we can take viruses like the polio virus, the vesicular stomatitis virus, vaccinia, which is in the same family as pox viruses. We can engineer those viruses to fight off cancer. So there's even a story recently about measles. The measles virus has been engineered. So we know how these viruses attach, kind of the lock and key I talked about in previous appearances. And we can use this to use these viruses to attach to a cancer cell and kill it. So there's cancers like melanoma, glioblastoma. I'm trying to think of some other ones. But there's a lot of work that's been done and a lot of advancements and some really good clinical data to show that these oncolytic viruses represent a good therapy. Now, it's not something that's widely available yet, but this is one instance where, you know, viruses are our friend.
All right. Jim, thank you very much for that one. The number is 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Marion writes in, I can protect myself from airborne viruses, but how can I prevent foodborne illnesses? We eat out a lot.
Yeah, that one, it can be challenging. You know, firstly, we live in a part of the world where we have access to clean water.
Right.
Most of the food is safe to utilize. So there aren't any, to my knowledge, you know, it's kind of an unlucky thing, right? If you just get food poisoning. I've had it, not pleasant.
Have you had it?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Oh, let's not talk about it. That would be great.
But, you know, things, for example, one of the more common causes, like norovirus, if we're on the topic of viruses, is a virus that can cause gastrointestinal distress. You can pick it up in daycare centers, long-term care facilities, cruise ships. It's often called as a cruise ship virus.
Right.
So there are certain pathogens and bacteria can cause food poisoning as well. And there is research active into trying to understand, can we prevent those types of, you know, inconveniences? And it can lead to some complications.
I thought all food poisoning was bacterial. You can eat a virus. I thought when you ate virus, your stomach acid destroyed it.
Some, depends how the virus is structured. So there are some, if you remember, I used that kind of candy shell analogy.
Yeah.
So there are some viruses that have this really protective candy shell, and it can even survive kind of the hostile environment of our GI tract and a low pH. So things like polio, for example, there are viruses that are in our body through fecal-oral route. Polio is one of those, norovirus is another.
Yeah.
So they're in a sense foodborne, but it's not from the food itself. It could just be handled food by someone that
didn't wash properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us. Viruses, they're not really alive, right?
That's a good question. It's kind of a philosophical question.
Well, here's my thing. If the tundra melts,
yeah,
and there is a woolly mammoth that's dead under the ice, and now it melts, is it possible that there are viruses still in that thing, that carcass, that could cause trouble?
I do like the sci-fi movie angle.
Yeah.
Did you pitch the script to Netflix?
I know, but I'm sure it's been done.
Yeah. There are certainly the what we know about the 1918 virus, actually, it was exhumed from individuals that were buried, I think, in Alaska. So viruses, if they're kept in certain conditions, they can persist. They're not alive per se, but the proteins and nucleic acids that make up a virus weren't damaged. So you could take that, and viruses need a host to replicate in. They lack the machinery to replicate.
Do they become alive when they have a host?
I would say, you know, depends what alive. I would say they're not alive in a sense like a bacteria or an eukaryotic cell or our cells are, because they can freely kind of produce energy on their own. They can replicate on their own. Viruses, you know, they need help to do that. So I think the term alive is not quite fitting.
And yet, maybe it's just evolution.
Yeah.
But they seem to exhibit intelligence in that they change form, or they will change their outer candy coating, as you will, to survive more. Now, is this just straight Darwinism, or is this something else?
It's more of the selective pressure. I mean, I'd like to think, you know, there's a, you know, kind of a Pixar or Disney movie of a virus with a, you know, eyes and a twisted, like twisting the mustache as it's trying to evolve. But
you know, Laurie Anderson wrote a song, "Language is a Virus." let's go grab one more, and then we'll take a break. Ed is in Akron. Ed. Hello, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I got a question.
Okay.
there are a lot of, you know, conspiracy theories about the COVID vax, that we were shedding spike proteins and some people's blood supposedly coagulated. And I think that was all kind of a stalking horse for Trumpism. But I digress. My question really is, I notice I get a lot fewer colds since I got several COVID vaccines.
Interesting.
Is that just my imagination, or is there a explanation for that? And also, when I do get a cold, it's usually a chest cold, and I used to get more head colds.
Interesting. All right, what do you think?
I'll hang up and listen to the response.
Ed, thanks a lot. All right, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating research in trying to understand the kind of the collaboration between different viruses and even viruses and bacteria. So there's like co-infections can happen. Can we stop those? And sometimes co-infections can either worsen disease or can, in some cases, they can protect us. So there's a lot of interactions that can take place. And for some vaccines, I mean, it could be partly a changing of behavior or a bit of luck not in encountering a certain virus like adenovirus that causes the cold. I mean, the vaccine itself is pretty specific against the COVID virus. But, you know, it's not unlikely or not impossible to say that when you get a vaccine, you kind of tickle the rest of your immune system and maybe that gets fired up a little bit. Again, not that specific immune response, more that innate ready to act response. So there could be some, you know, some cross protection. I think what scientists and clinicians typically do if they're looking to really protect against more than one pathogen, they'll do these combination vaccines. Like, for example, the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, and in some cases combined with varicella for chickenpox. So in that case, it's defined which viruses, in this case, we're trying to protect a person from.
Let's take a quick break. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, 800-348-2551. Oh, yeah, Grant Green, high-heeled sneakers, yeah? Okay, go. It's the lockbox, you know. We have another several days, and we are really rolling. And thanks to you for everything you have done. If you've made a pledge, thanks a lot. WAMC.org is where you can make a secure online pledge. I didn't look just now, but we're well over 500,000 in the lockbox. The fund drive starts Monday morning at 6, and then it's wall-to-wall fundraising. So the sooner you make the pledge to the lockbox, the shorter the fund drive is. Thanks so much for everything you've done. Number here on this program is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us every so often. Before he leaves today, I'll book him for next year, too. Caroline writes in, I had a very bad case of RSV last year and was hospitalized twice because it was made worse due to my asthma. It affected my lungs. I couldn't even sing for almost a year afterwards. I'm 75 now. Would like to believe that I'm immune to RSV now. Is this true? I've had my flu shots and numerous COVID boosters.
Yeah, there's two ways you can acquire immunity towards a pathogen. And I'm glad that the writer shared their story. I'd like to highlight, like, RSV is severe. It can really cause complications. And,
yeah.
In terms of acquiring protection and immunity we were talking about, you can either get it through natural infection or vaccination. And, you know, they tend to be equivalent, but the problem here is with the natural route, right, you get disease. So you have, like, all the bad symptoms, you're hospitalized, can't sing and things like that.
So I can't sing now and I'm quite healthy, actually.
So I don't think it's the RSV in your case.
No.
Or mine.
No.
Likely you have protection after natural infection. Now, there's some, in some cases, you know, we won't get into the kind of the weeds of, is it the right protection? But, you know, with the individual's case here of RSV, she likely has protection against it. And again, it would be worth still talking to her doctor, you know.
Yeah.
Is it still worth getting the vaccine to kind of even increase the immunity?
Is there any way, if money was no object, to test and see if you have immunity? In other words, she got RSV.
Yeah.
Is there a way the doctor could say, all right, let's find out if you have any immunity?
Antibodies are relatively easy to test as long as there's, tests that are available. You just draw some blood and you can test for antibodies. The other cell types, it's a little bit more challenging. Those T cells I mentioned that play a very important role. It's just a bit more complex to test for those.
Okay.
There are tests out there, but I think that's something that, you know, maybe as tests become more refined and maybe even hopefully someday affordable,
yeah.
You can get a panel of, like, you know, what you've been exposed to, how protected are you?
Cool. All right. This is from Gracie in Sheffield, Mass. John and I, J John 89, me 82, both had the Hong Kong flu back in the late 60s, early 70s, when he was in college in Illinois. We were really sick. Day by day, the radio told us how many thousands had died the day before. Did surviving the Hong Kong flu give us any protection against COVID?
It's unlikely because they were completely different viruses. So the, suffering through the Hong Kong flu that the caller did, you were left with protection against that virus, definitely. The antibodies and T cells you have recognize that virus, and probably some protection against flu viruses that were similar enough. But COVID and flu are distinct viruses, so unfortunately there's not this cross protection against the two.
All right, Cindy writes in, I need to get my flu and COVID shots separately. What's the optimal length of time to wait in between?
In some individuals, you can get them at the same time. Like, I think the recommendation that I saw that last was, one in each arm. But again, some cases, like we were talking before during the break, you get a vaccine, sometimes you have those, side effects. And with those side effects, you feel is your immune system reacting against the vaccine. So it's not always pleasant, but in some cases that it indicates that it's working. Now, if you don't get those side effects, it doesn't mean you weren't given a vaccine or your system's not responding. But I think in terms of spacing out, sometimes that's recommended if you want to not deal with the complications. You don't want to miss work, for example.
Yeah.
Again, I would refer that individual to speak to their doctor to see what's a good spacing. But again, there's no reason why you can't get them at the same time if you're looking to just do one visit.
I try to time my vaccine so I can miss work. That's really my trick. It's funny you mentioned this about the reaction to vaccines.
Yeah.
Well, I had the COVID vaccines. I never had a reaction, and I was thinking to myself, "Wow, this thing did nothing. I'm gonna get the COVID," but it obviously didn't happen. Good. But why do some people get worse effects?
It's partly genetics and just how your body responds to the components. I could do a whole show on what's in a vaccine, but the vaccine contains
little soldiers. Clearly,
little soldiers. So it contains you hear the term antigen if you look up some of the nomenclature, but that's the part of the pathogen we want the immune system to be educated against because that's going to protect us. So that's one part that's in the vaccine. Some vaccines have what's called an adjuvant. And an adjuvant is kind of like a laundry booster. Anyone use that? You're trying to get your clothes extra bright.
Yeah.
So the adjuvant kind of helps improve that response. And in some cases, in some individuals, they have a vigorous response to it. And some of it's just self-reported. Like if you're someone that's used to aches and pains and you feel aches and pains, you're like, just another day.
Oh, yeah. So. That's it. All right. Let's go try Samantha in Deer Park again. Maybe she's in a better spot. Hello, Samantha.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Perfectly. Go ahead.
Good. So, Dr. Yeager, I just have a question. So I work in the ICU and I have a young baby. He's a 9-month-old. And naturally, I'm afraid of bringing home viruses to my baby. So I saw that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends the COVID vaccine for children aged 6 months to 2 years of age because they're at increased risk for hospitalization. However, the vaccine is not available anywhere. I called several different pediatricians. The Department of Health doesn't have it for that population either, even though it's recommended by the DOH as well. So how strongly do you recommend the COVID vaccine, and should I drive to Canada to get it?
Mercy.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Samantha. And what we're dealing with is kind of the confusion that's happened with what's called the ACIP. So the ACIP is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and historically their job has been to provide expert guidance to the CDC and the Health and Human Services Secretary on vaccines and vaccine schedules. And they met back in September, and they kind of changed the recommendations for the COVID vaccine. They changed it so that it was, before it was we had this blanket recommendation. As Samantha mentioned, before it was, recommended for infants over the ages of 6 months, pregnant individuals, the elderly, and adults at risk. And the group changed the recommendations. And this group is typically made up of scientists, epidemiologists, and doctors. And the recommendation was to change it to a shared decision making for adults over the age of 65. Which, in those individuals, I should make should state too that COVID is still here. It's still causing hospitalizations, still causing deaths in a variety of populations, particularly those at risk.
Probably always will. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So they've changed the recommendation, which has added a lot of confusion both federal level, state level, insurers are trying to figure out what to do, because typically insurance companies follow ACIP. They'll cover ACIP-recommended vaccines. So what's happening now is the states are kind of taking on some of the role for recommendations for a variety of reasons. There's a West Coast Health Alliance, which includes states like California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, and they have recommendations that are kind of what they were prior to the ACIP's current recommendation change,
okay,
where they would recommend a vaccine for young children, again, pregnant individuals, older individuals. And New York is now part of what's called the Northeast Public Health Collaborative, with other states like Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maine, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. Okay. And they have similar recommendations that mirror the group that Samantha mentioned. So in addition to these collective of states, public health officials working at the state level, there are physician groups working as well with these recommendations. So I think what's really making it, we have to wait and see what's happening, is the accessibility is an issue. Is like, I think probably the pharmacies, even maybe the doctor's offices, insurance companies are trying to figure out what they're, how to do this. And it's like that, unfortunately, is impacting the availability.
Yeah.
My optimism is that with, you know, having these collaboratives, these alliances, there's some push there to say, okay, let's figure this out. Drug manufacturers, let's get the vaccines to our clinics and make them available. Because clearly, you know, the vaccines, you know, it is certainly a political hot issue. But the data that's out there is COVID is still around. It's causing hospitalizations and deaths. And the vaccines, the data we still have collected, even to this day, really shows, you know, that it does reduce the risk of complications, hospitalizations, and severe outcomes. You know, so it's not, it, you know, it doesn't make you bulletproof. You're not 100% protected.
Right.
And I think initially we had that, really wanted that. But now it's, you know, the understanding, just like with our flu vaccine, you might still get sick, but you're not going to get as sick. You may not need to go to the doctor or the hospital. You don't need to be intubated, things like that.
Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from UAlbany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, genetics. What are you, immunology this time too?
Yep.
Boy,
all the fun stuff.
I'll tell you, you have one heck of a job. All right, we're wrapping it up here. We got about 10 minutes to go. Let's go to Schenectady. Sandy, you're on.
Hi there. Good afternoon, Dr. Yeager. Good afternoon, Ray.
Hello.
I have a question about naturally acquired immunity that is quite ancient.
Okay.
I got measles in 1957 or 58, before there were readily available vaccines. Should I get a measles vaccine?
I love this question.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Sandy. Thank you. So there's individuals... before we had the measles vaccine, so it was kind of more of an endemic virus, so that people would get it. And the year that Sandy mentioned is kind of anyone born before 1957, they're presumed to have natural immunity due to exposure to the measles. And the current understanding is that that protection persists.
Forever?
For as long as there's probably studies that are going to start to come out more since measles is back on kind of the radar.
Right.
Is to see how long that protection lasts.
Like, yeah.
And it, you know, again, talking with your doctor, certain conditions, maybe you want to say, you know, should we test antibody levels? You know, did I truly have measles that was not misdiagnosed?
Yeah,
You know, and maybe in some cases it's worth getting a dose. I know it's not something that everyone has to run out and get a booster dose. Again, right now we're looking at, you know, the health groups and doctors like, okay, what groups? Certainly if you're unvaccinated, you're at a higher risk because measles is one of the most contagious respiratory viruses we know. One person can infect 12 to 18 other individuals. And most of those new cases are caused in unvaccinated individuals. And measles is something that can, you know, just like with flu and RSV, like you might not think of it as something problematic, but this virus can be quite severe. You know, it can cause pneumonia due to secondary bacterial infections, severe ear infections, diarrhea, encephalitis. It can be fatal. It can cause a terrible illness called SSPE, which is where 7 years after you've recovered, you start to have neurological defects.
7 years?
7 years.
What kind of, how is that fair in any way?
And it's somewhat similar to polio does that, to something called post-polio syndrome. So there's, you know, some viruses are insidious that you think you've recovered, you're fine, and then years later, these worsening symptoms appear. And
that,
So I think it's, and even worse yet, measles can cause immune amnesia, which is kind of, you know, as an immunologist, it's kind of cool, but also scary.
Wow, interesting. Sandy, you want to follow up before we say goodbye?
I want to thank you very much. And oh, did I have measles?
Oh,
did I ever.
Oh, man. Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you, Sandy.
I hope you don't get them again.
Agreed.
Let's go either to Greenwich, New York or Greenwich, Connecticut. Kathy, hello.
Hi. So I had a question regarding the number of vaccines per year, and is there currently any studies underway post-COVID to study people who had 6 to 8 possibly vaccines a year?
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. So that one of the questions that comes up about vaccines is like, you know, is there this risk that you could overwhelm the immune system?
Yeah.
And with the vaccines we have today, they're very defined with the antigen, right? We want to, if we're trying to educate our immune system, you know, we want to tell our immune system what chapters are read in a textbook, right? Like, you need to focus on this for the exam or the disease. Whereas past vaccines, you know, just throw the whole book.
Right.
So there are vaccines called whole cell vaccines, and those, you know, could cause more side effects. And we kind of switch more to these defined antigens. So with that, the number of antigens you get in vaccines, you know, is limited. And it's actually, when you think about what you're exposed to on a daily basis, even if you're infected with like flu or something else, like it's minor compared to what you're exposed to on a daily basis. So the current understanding is that, you know, there doesn't seem to be, you know, like an overwhelming of the immune system. That's true for children or adults. What they do look for, though, is, you know, when you think about the spacing or the schedule of vaccines, it's like, what's your overall risk? If you get the vaccine, how long is that protection going to last? Is it a vaccine that's going to protect you for a year, decades, maybe for life? How do we bring those in? And in some cases, too, there are certain vaccines that, you know, don't mix well for whatever reasons. So I think in some cases they space them out. So I'd say in general, there's, you know, there's no data I'm aware of currently to say, oh, you know, don't get more than 5 vaccines a year.
Right. Like
if you get, you know, if you're in an age group that you need to get flu, RSV, COVID, and pneumonia, and shingles, you're going to get those vaccines because, you know, you're at risk for complications.
All right. Kathy, thanks a lot. Speaking of shingles, let's go quickly. We only have about a minute here with Will in Albany. Will, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. Yeah, I'm 73. I just got shingles about 6 weeks ago, even though I had the chicken pox vaccine when I was a kid. Now what do I do?
Oh, boy.
They gave me the RX for it, but it didn't work.
Oh, sorry to hear that, Will. I know I had a family experience with shingles, very painful. So what shingles is, for those listeners, it's a reactivation of the chickenpox virus. So there are some viruses that go latent, you're infected, and then they go quiet, they hibernate.
So this is somewhat like the SSPE or whatever you were saying, right? It just sits around?
Yeah, in that case, it's something that's not directly related to the virus. It's just causing something damaged in the body during that initial infection. But here, the virus is still present. Your body hasn't eliminated it, and it reactivates, and it causes that painful rash. And this virus kind of resides in neurons, so that's why it's so painful.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, can I recommend, you know, Will, talking with your doctor, I think there is if you have active shingles, I think there's a time period they want to wait until it resolves before, but my understanding is...
You said about 3 months.
Yeah. So you have, like, your immune system is active, but you can get the vaccine, and the reason why the shingles vaccine is recommended is that the data is really good to suggest that it reduces the possibility of getting shingles, and if you do get it, it reduces the severity. Because in some cases, the pain can last... into multiple months and years, and it can be debilitating. So the shingles vaccine, the current iteration out there, is very good, and that protection is long lasting. So if you're able to get that vaccine, you know, hopefully that'll keep you set for, you know, several years from having, you know, outbreaks again.
All right, Will, thank you very much. We got to leave it there. By the way, Doc, you're going to have to get the shingles too, huh?
I know, at that age. Any advice, Ray?
Well, I mean, you know, I had it, and they say, oh, this hurts, this is bad. I didn't really have much of a reaction to it.
That's good.
So
I have hope.
You know, of course, everybody, your results may vary.
That's right.
All right, Dr. Eric Yeager, it's always great having you on this program. And as I said, before you leave, we're going to make sure you're on next year.
Thanks
okay?
again. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to share my hopeful wisdom and expertise with the audience.
And hopefully, you know, no pandemics. And you just, we just like today, we get on, we talk about stuff.
That's right.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon. Support Thank comes you. From ArtSpark, Saratoga Springs, New York. Digital marketing and web design for all creatives, taking artists and arts businesses online, artspark.com. Ballet Flowers and Design, Malta, New York, a family-owned garden center and flower farm, offering landscape, wedding design services, perennials, annuals, herbs, and interactive classes, balletflowers.com. And the Olana Partnership, presenting What's Missing, Artworks in the Olana Landscape, Outdoor Artworks by Ellen Harvey, Gabriella Salazar, revealing missing pieces of Olana's landscape, olana.org/what's missing. Well, that's it for today. Thanks again to Dr. Eric Yeager for being here.
thank you for the questions. Sorry if we did not get to yours today. We will have Eric again on this program. Thanks to our engineer today, Mike Bowen. Phone screened by Andrea Leong. Thank you, Andrea. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we garden. And I'll tell you this little secret. When they were all leaving last time, 2 weeks ago, I said, I'll send you a reminder. And they all laughed at me because I send a reminder like, oh, I oversend. And this time I'm not going to send a reminder. So if they don't show up, it's on them. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.